Hang on, should I? Hang on, stop.
What's wrong?
Did you see that I need permission to record?
Oh, no.
Yeah. I was like, maybe I should flag this now rather than at the end.
What did it do?
So when I click record on this computer, it says ask the host to give you permission to record.
And did you click ask host? Or was there no?
No, it just says, and then it's just closed. So it's maybe like verbally. So please give me permission to.
Cool. Yes, but I don't know where. See if you can record now.
Okay.
Oh, and I can't record because I'm using apps. Recording in progress. That. Maybe a good thing. Maybe that's a Vivitel. Hmm?
I just, yeah.
Yeah?
Yep. Okay. Yep, I'm recording.
All right.
Yep.
Beautiful. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not recording, okay?
All right.
Good job, James.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Can
here
you
we
mute
go.
Him?
Let's try that again.
And go.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff.
Teach a man not to defend himself when he is the constant victim of brutal attacks.
I discharge my last duty as king.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It really is a revolution.
Upon this battle depends the survival.
Roger, we'll stop Discovery. Welcome back. A great ending to the new beginning.
Welcome back to How Did It Come to This, where remembering history reinterprets the news. Sitting in her home on Zoom is a woman who believes the Soviets lost in Afghanistan because there were Russian things. It's Siobhan Doherty.
Hi, guys.
And in his apartment, far enough away that we can't hear him on the mic, is a man who knows Rambo would solve every problem. It's James Suckwell.
Howdy.
He's yelling. You know what?
Yeah, you can hear him.
I can hear you better than like when you're sitting right next to me.
I'm sorry.
How about this technology?
That's pretty good. well.
And who are you?
Well, I'm Daniel Matters. Yep.
A man who is knowledgeable AF about Afghanistan.
Wow.
Okay. So I really tried to come up with like a witty sort of reference.
Sure.
Between like something about the Twin Towers with Lord of the Rings. The Two Towers in Lord of the Rings with the Twin Towers. But I couldn't come up with something without sounding quite glib. And that's really not the time
sure.
you want to take.
No, no, so, I don't think so. That's
so, I know that was bordering on, you know, not very appropriate, but I thought I was towing with the line, but not going over it.
Sure. Look, you know, I'm glad you tried. It was, you gave it a good try and we're here for it.
Thanks.
Well, we're back. Yay. It's been a while, mostly because here in New South Wales, we've had mega lockdown.
Huge.
Been in my home for almost 12 weeks now. And meant we couldn't get to our equipment and we couldn't do lots of things and it was really difficult. And also, Siobhan had a baby. Yay!
I had a baby.
Yeah.
Yay! And she doesn't know what the outside world looks like.
No.
She was like 4 days old when we went into lockdown. So.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. She thinks the whole world is this little house.
Yeah. That's pretty cool though. Yeah. You know.
Well, yeah.
The world is your mum and dad.
Yeah.
But that's exciting. And so we are back and we're hoping to be back in a regular way. If you didn't see our little post the other day, I did receive some new equipment, and I'm very, very excited. So thanks to my wife for allowing us to let me record from home. It's pretty impressive, and I'm very excited. All right.
Yeah,
so
awesome.
This week on How Did It Come to This? From emirates to kingdoms, republics, both democratic and otherwise, to Islamic states and foreign invaders, the land of the Afghan has been fought over for centuries. A strategic stronghold bridging Asia and the Middle East, pawn in the great game of colonial powers. The battle for the heart of Asia has seen empires rise and fall. Where is Afghanistan? Why is it of such strategic value? How many wars can be fought by foreign powers over a sovereign nation? Can Afghanistan ever truly be free? And can Rambo come back and save the Afghani peoples? Ultimately, how did it come to this?
Okay, I want to start with a fun fact because there aren't going to be many in this.
Oh, what?
Fun facts. Fun facts. Fun facts. With Siobhan.
I had to be quick on the uptake there. You surprised me with a fun fact. Like, all right, okay, go. Yeah,
I've been so excited to do a fun fact. So it's about Afghan versus Afghani.
Oh, right, yes, okay. I didn't actually look it up. I just wrote the intro.
That's all right. That's okay. So
fun fact me.
Fun fact you. Afghan is the noun and the adjective.
Mm-hmm.
And Afghani is a unit of currency.
So I just called them money.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's a whoops. Afghan people. I'm sorry.
So the reason I brought it up and I wanted to bring it up early is when this was all on the news, like a few weeks ago, like even very well-respected news outlets were saying Afghani, and it was just driving me nuts.
Sure.
So like, just think, the Afghan rug cost 500 Afghani, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's my fun fact.
Yeah, no, that's a good one.
It's the only one I've got because the rest of the story is quite sad. So I don't want to.
This one's not a fun topic.
No, really interesting, but not much room for fun facts.
And we thought, because you know, like, so a lot of stuff obviously happened while we were away, but this one was a big one, and also when we were looking into it, like the history of this little country is so fraught we've decided to make two episodes.
Mm. James even suggested five.
James did suggest five. Look, there's probably enough content for five, but we're not going to do that. So
we'll go all the way back to Alexander the Great.
Yeah. this topic is it's not a fun one, but it does have a lot in it. So let's get started. I've got a news article here from today, actually. Mm-hmm. So this is from The Conversation today. This is September 30th, 2021, titled Afghanistan Shows the US Folly of Trying to Implant Democratic Institutions Abroad. It's a really good article, actually, if you're interested. But it's it says... The rapid conquest of Kabul in Afghanistan and the triumphant seizure of power by the Taliban triggered shockwaves throughout the world. Since the crumbling of the Afghan government and disintegration of its professionally trained army, a volley of scorching criticisms has been launched at US President Joe Biden's administration for withdrawing American forces from Afghanistan. But the collapse of the Afghan government was likely inevitable. Furthermore, the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and continuing political instability in Iraq provide painful but valuable lessons for those who insist on implanting democracy in a socio-political environment that's profoundly shaped by inveterate tribal loyalty, kinship, and sectarian affiliation.
Yeah.
And I thought that this article, like, so that little intro there kind of sums up a lot of what...
Sums it all up, yeah.
The history is about.
Although I do hate that idea of inevitability in history. Like, I say it to the kids all the time. Mm-hmm, like, nothing's inevitable. Like, you know, there was like a period in time where this could have been different. But I think, blame definitely has to be placed squarely on the Americans for this.
sure. And like, you know, I feel like that's something that, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this show in the first place, was the idea of the inevitability of some things in history. Well, why can't we learn? People learn, Siobhan?
That's it. Maybe that's the one thing that is inevitable.
Yeah, maybe.
Not being able to learn from it.
Oh, no. Mm, terrible.
Yeah.
All right. So
we've divided this up.
Yes.
So we're going to do this episode is on the history of Afghanistan up to September 11, 2001.
Yes.
And then episode two will be everything that came after.
Yes.
So, like, it's going to be hard not to talk about it, like, you know, the situation today, like Afghanistan as it is today.
For sure.
But we do want to save that for... Just call me out if I start going into...
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's definitely like... Shush. Yeah, it's a... like, the history that we're going to go through today spans a long, long time, and a lot of different things happen, and it's crazy... Like, we're going to leave out so much. So, but, you know, the period of the last 20 years too has so much that happened as well.
And
it's probably a little bit more relevant, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, that's kind of why we decided to split it there.
I think, like, even like people our age, like they know, probably they remember September 11 and they know all about the last 20 years, but yes. Like I don't think many of them would be aware of all the, like, the 80s and the 90s Afghanistan and even before,
for sure.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to head back and we're going to go back to I've put down a date of 1823. That's where I wanted to start.
Sounds good.
Yep. Okay. We're going to go back to 1823 and to take us there. Thank you, Wayne and Garth.
Aww.
They're back.
You guys.
They're back. we're going to go back to 1823 and we're going back to what is known as the Emirate of Afghanistan. And this is the first time that Afghanistan is a sovereign country, I guess, really. Yeah. Like, it's the it's the first time that Afghanistan is recognized as a country as we would know it today. It is an emirate. I thought I'd just quickly, just for some people, because I know, like, a lot of people, especially a lot of students that I talk to, they have no idea about this region of the world. So Afghanistan is a country about the size of France. And it is in the area between Iran, Pakistan, Tajikistan to the north, and then it's got China on the east, and kind of like India's kind of to the southeast, but that border's disputed because it's in Kashmir, which is a whole nother story.
So, like, before 1947, it bordered India.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So it's got this real strategic significance in terms of where it sits in the world. So it sits right on, like, so on its eastern border, it's got the Himalayas, and it like then leads into China. But then on its western borders, it goes straight into the heart of the Middle East. It sits in this area where, especially like, but prior to 1823, obviously, like a long, long time ago, it was a key point on the Silk Road. So it's always had this real strategic significance, and it forms as an emirate, and it pretty much becomes part of colonial wars almost straight out of the gate.
It's like the gateway between Asia and the Middle East, and that whole region is sought after by European colonialists for all of its natural resources. And from the very beginning, with tension.
So what I kind of looked at, so at the beginning of this kind of period, in the 1800s, mid 1800s, so England, Britain is trying to protect its colonial interests around the world, the crown jewel of which is India. Which always, fascinatingly enough,
all that butter chicken.
That's right. fascinatingly enough, I always loved the fact that India was not technically ruled by Great Britain, but the East India Company for a long period of time. That always fascinates me. But anyway, but so in protecting its interests, it actually started to push northwards. And what was happening on the other side of the world was that Russia was pushing south into a lot of Asian countries. So they were kind of in this pincer.
Down through Mongolia and into China.
They're kind of in this pincer movement where Russia is trying to gain colonial significance as well. And the way it's doing that is expanding naturally from its borders, whereas Britain was expanding sort of like more
using its navy, using the seas
and that.
Yeah.
So Britain was kind of trying to proceed northwards through India, and it wanted to stop Russia's advance trying to get to India, which is kind of where Afghanistan comes into the equation.
It's nice to see a 19th century colonial dispute between England and someone other than France.
Sure, but did you know? I didn't know this before I researched this, but Napoleon Napoleon went to Tsar Paul the First of Russia. I can't remember the date, but he went to Tsar Paul the First of Russia, and he was like, "Hey, let's go and invade India through Afghanistan."
You know what would make Britain really mad?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good idea. And Paul's like, it doesn't sound like such a great idea. I'm not really not so sure about it. But then they did it anyway. So
France is involved.
Is involved.
Good on you, France.
Yeah, well done. So there's a lot of back and forth between the Russians and the British over a number of years. And in fact, so between 1823 and 1839, it's the Emirate of Afghanistan. And then in 1839, the Anglo-Afghan wars are going on, and they have to give up their sovereignty to England, who win in Afghanistan and take over most of the country.
Yeah. And win for a couple of reasons, not just like because of their, you know, superiority in terms of like technology and things like that, but like probably a good time to just point out how fractured Afghanistan is as a nation in terms of like the ethnicities like the tribal sort of nature of it. Mm-hmm. So like it's difficult for them to unite. Obviously having an enemy like Britain probably makes it easier for them to all come together, but yeah, it's very tribal. And like this is like a theme that we see even today with Afghanistan. So
from what I could determine, there's sort of 7 or 8 different real major ethnic groups in Afghanistan.
I didn't look up how many, but the Pashtuns are the main ones.
Yeah, the Pashtuns, like
the majority.
There's just a bunch of like other tribal places, but there's a lot of Uzbek and Turkmen people who obviously like shared borders. So a lot of those.
Well, it comes back to like the arbitrary drawing of national borders,
which is
like
another consequence of colonialism. So for those of those listeners who don't really know what we're talking about there, so a lot of the colonial powers when they start taking over other nations for their own interests, they just kind of arbitrarily draw some borders on what they think is good for them, strategically or economically, or or if they've lost the war to another European power. So a lot of places in Africa and Asia that just kind of divided arbitrarily
and with very little understanding of like local culture and ethnic groups and things like that.
So there's a lot of different nationalities, different ethnic groups, different languages spoken in Afghanistan too. So yeah, it is very
different religions as well.
I don't know if divided is the right term, but it's definitely not a.
I think fractured.
Yeah, fractured. Like yeah, that's probably a good way to describe it. Yeah. So the first Anglo-Afghan War happens and England take over for a couple of years, but then there is an inevitable, Afghan victory. And the Emirate comes back in 1842.
So like it's easy to defeat them, but it's difficult to hold on to power there.
Yeah. Like, and this is something that I've
again another theme, but
yeah, this is a thing that you often hear. And like, you know, I've listened to other podcasts on this before too, and you know, news articles and whatever, like other journalists talking about this, historians, about the idea that, you know, Afghanistan seems easy to walk into. But you can like it's just impossible to hold on to. So it's going to be
so the term that they coined was the graveyard of empires. And Joe Biden actually used that recently in a speech. And I don't know, like the podcasts and the research I was doing when in preparation for this, like that it's a very imperialist view to sort of call it that. And so maybe fitting in the 1900s, but kind of disappointing that Joe Biden would refer to Afghanistan that way, like today, because it's a very imperialist view of the country. You know what I mean?
I'm sure there are a lot of people who would agree with the notion that America is imperialist.
Yeah, and that is disappointing.
Very much so. Look, that was the first. That's the first Anglo-Afghan War. I feel like we're already running out of time here because there's another Anglo-Afghan wars.
I didn't research them really.
So, no, but what essentially is going on is Britain is just they just keep coming back. They just keep trying again and again. But the Emirate of Afghanistan kind of remains between 1842 to 1926. They're able to hold on to the their own country, which is nice, I guess.
Yeah. So a little thing that happened like just before that was World War One, which is an explanation for why
the British are more willing to give up.
Like they lost the third British-Afghan War, mm-hmm. lost the third one, and probably because they just were war weary and willing to give it up. That's sort of around 1919 kind of when there starts to be more of a movement against the British in Afghanistan because they saw the opportunity.
Well, because, and prior to the third Anglo-Afghan War, the Russians leave Afghanistan as well, primarily because they lose to Japan. It's because they lose to Japan. So in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, things are definitely not going well for Tsar Nicholas II, and he decides that maybe a peace treaty is probably the best course of action in Afghanistan.
They quietly
leave. I mean they'll be back, but not during Nicholas's lifetime. But after the Treaty of 1919 between the British and Afghanistan, they're their own thing for a little while until 1926, when the Kingdom of Afghanistan is formed, This is an interesting one because it goes until 1973, so it's probably the longest period of time for any of the governments that we're looking at. Actually,
on the books, looks like it might be stable,
but it's not
in reality, not so much.
Not really. The king, Aminullah Khan. I didn't want to butcher it.
That's all right. I'll do it for you.
Yeah, thank you. And he was really keen on doing a lot of things that were quite good for Afghanistan, I guess.
This is what I was so surprised about. And of all of the periods of time in Afghanistan, this looks like, you know, the time that I kind of like the most. He deposed his father.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very sympathetic to the revolutionaries of 1919. So he deposed his father, but then he himself became king, and he was concerned that Afghanistan was falling behind the rest of the world.
Yes.
And so starts a program of economic and social reform. And I was actually very interested in his wife, Queen Soraya.
Okay.
So she...
Tell me about her.
She opened schools for girls.
Yeah.
This is sort of where we really start to see a focus on women's rights in Afghanistan. I'm not sure if they get the vote, but, you know, certainly like political representation is
discussed. Okay. Yeah, right. I didn't see this bit. This is good.
Yeah. And she, if you like Google a picture of her, she looks like a flapper.
Oh, really?
That
doesn't surprise me because the king was quite enamored by European
Western things, which became a problem. But their whole thing was that we do not have to give up on, the teachings of Islam in order to progress as a society. Like the two things can exist together. So they were very progressive, but it caused problems.
That's probably too. Like if you think about Iran during this point in time, too. You know, they're a very progressive Islamic society as well at this point in time. Yeah. So that's okay. That's fascinating. I know he definitely went on a big, he was very keen on the idea of modernizing Afghanistan and bringing it up to speed, especially post World War One. He didn't want to fall behind the rest of the world, especially especially I suppose looking back on how the history against the British had gone, he didn't want to fall into, you know, being left behind. Vulnerable to those types of things again. Unfortunately,
it didn't last.
It didn't last. There was a lot of conservative forces within Afghanistan who didn't like what he was doing. And there were quite a few.
Also rural. So I think he and his wife had to flee the country in like 1933.
Mm-hmm.
I know that she was in Italy when she died in the 60s.
Right.
But yeah, the conservatives didn't like them because of their very liberal take on, Muslim teachings.
Yep.
But also Afghanistan's a really rural agricultural. Like once you go outside of Kabul and the main cities, it's very rural.
Yes.
And they were seen to be kind of elite and classists, and so all of the great things they were doing really benefited the wealthy people in the cities. Yeah. But there was a big movement against them in the countryside, which is most of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Mm. So I know that, yeah, he was deposed by Muhammad Nadir. Muhammad Zahir Shah. Sorry. Which is his son.
Is his cousin?
It says his son here is what I've got. The cousin comes at the end. Muhammad Zahir Shah, he ruled in 1933 and his rule lasts for 39 years.
Yeah.
And he essentially starts it's not, his reign's not as controversial, I guess, as his dad was. And he just kind of keeps the peace for the 39 years. But then he is overthrown by his cousin, Muhammad Daoud Khan.
Okay.
And he's the one he's the one who gets rid of the monarchy.
Yes. Makes himself president
and establishes the
Republic of Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's right. Which, happens in 1973, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a bloodless coup, apparently. So just, quite easy to just overthrow him. One key thing that happens in between that time, I think 1947, the creation of India, the British withdrawal from India, and the creation of India as a nation state, which also means the creation of Pakistan. Because I found it really interesting as I was reading, like, the histories of Pakistan and Afghanistan are, intrinsically linked.
Yeah, well, because the other thing, the other interesting, actually, I've got a bit of a fun fact.
Go!
Because Pakistan is another one of these arbitrarily drawn up countries.
Absolutely.
What I recently learned is that the name Pakistan is actually an acronym. Did you know this?
Oh, I think I knew this, but remind me. Yeah, go.
So Paki is, each letter represents a nationality of one of the people groups within Pakistan itself.
There you go.
It never kind of was a cohesive country. It just kind of got created out of the formation of India and other arbitrarily drawn up places when England was kind of leaving the place.
India is mainly Hindu, but a secular state, and so the Muslims of India didn't like that, and so like the compromise was like, we'll create your own country where you can do what you want. But yeah, it caused huge upheaval.
It did.
Oh yes. relevant, but not relevant to what we're talking about, other than the Pakistan's really important for Afghanistan.
Yeah, Pakistan is you'll often hear, and actually probably become more relevant next week when we're talking about post 2001 kind of issues. But it becomes relevant because the longest shared border with Afghanistan is Pakistan. There's almost free travel between the two countries. Like Pakistan is not, they don't care that much about people crossing the border. Let's put it that way.
Right.
To Afghanistan at least. So it has allowed a lot of things to happen which probably could have been avoided had that been different. Back to the Republic of Afghanistan.
Yeah, so we're up to 1973.
1974. This poor Republic of Afghanistan, they last 4 years.
This is another thing too, like reading all of this, you just feel for the people, like they've just been through so much, and none of it's their faults. And like every time they said, like, you know, a change of government, this guy became president, none of this was particularly popular with the people. It just happened. Yep. Like, it's just like, oh gosh.
Daoud, he's the guy that deposed his cousin and forms the Republic of Afghanistan, and they often referred to the Republic of Afghanistan as the Daoud Republic. And he also tried to do a bunch of modernizing, and he's known for, he was quite autocratic in what he was trying to do. And he tried to do things with a lot of help from outside influences, most notably the Soviets and the United States, kind of playing both sides, I guess. That didn't, lots of people didn't like that idea.
Yeah. So I read that he was pro-Soviet, but not necessarily communist himself, just happy to accept aid. And like, obviously if we think about this in the bigger context of what's happening in the world in the 70s, you've got like Cold War and like proxy wars going on. So the West and the Soviet Union are going to be competing for influence over countries like Afghanistan, who are in desperate need of aid.
Yes.
In order to modernize.
Yeah, for sure. He was, you know, he was trying to do a lot of things at once, and he was trying to do it kind of all by himself. With not much help, which, that wasn't going to work for him in a place like Afghanistan. And so in 1978, there is another military coup. Known as the Saur Revolution.
This one was not bloodless.
It was not bloodless, especially because, so Daoud and his family are killed in this coup. The whole family. It's definitely... definitely wasn't a bloodless coup. But they then go on to form, ironically enough, the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan.
I love these names. It's like you read it, you're like, oh, sounds good. And then you read about it and you're like, no, not good.
Yeah.
Not good.
Not unlike most places that call themselves a Democratic Republic of. They're
be
not...
wary of any country that says that we're the Democratic Republic. Probably not.
This is a longer period of time in the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, although they do change their name from the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan to just the Republic of Afghanistan.
It was very confusing.
But
these guys are communists.
And they, during this time period, this is the time period in which, everything kind of pops off with the Soviets too.
Should I just stop? Should we throw James a fact check?
Sure.
He's like, I bet he's just sitting there for something.
Sure.
James, can you fact check me what happened to Daoud?
Daoud.
Fact check me.
Are
you there?
He's there. I thought he might have dropped off the Zoom.
He was overthrown and killed.
Yeah, but how?
How
deep? Who else? Because I know that there were like other people with him.
I don't know what happened, but I'm going to go for firing squad. Let's see. See if you can find it.
A public hanging.
Yeah. Let's see. The Democratic Republic of Afghanistan begins in 1978, and they kind of get to work in doing lots of different reforms. Land reforms, marriage reforms being the two biggest ones that kind of popped out in my research.
That's so communist, isn't it?
It is. It is. Isn't
Let's
it?
Start with some land reforms.
Yeah.
But like the thing is though, like especially when you're reading about the marriage reforms, like there was a lot of like, again, like women's rights and things like that that I, you know, are good.
Yeah.
They're good reforms. They're all about equal, no matter what, your gender or whatever. Like, and so you're reading it all, you're like, oh, like it sounds good, but the other ideas you have are just not.
Yeah.
Like censoring the press and your need to have a military force to enforce everything you're doing and the lack of actual democratic elections and
yep.
everything else.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so like that. Yeah, there was quite a few. Like, because from what I read, Daoud in the previous government had started kind of a lot of equal rights for women stuff, and then the new leader Amin, he started adding on to that, and kind of expanded quite a lot of those. I don't want to say freedoms, but I guess.
Like
kind of freedoms.
They are like, yeah.
And like, yeah, he, so there's a lot of things going on in terms of like, because I suppose one of the things about a communist government is that they do believe that everyone's just the same. Everyone's a worker. Like, so, you know, yeah. I guess that kind of makes sense.
And we can acknowledge that things aren't black and white and that it's not like, you know, communism bad. It's like, well,
sure.
You know, it hasn't worked long-term for anyone, but some of their ideas about equality are good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
But, yeah, it doesn't last very long before they start having to deal with some upheaval.
Yeah, so there's quite a few, there's a couple of groups that really don't like the idea of becoming a communist Afghanistan. And a lot of the things that are happening. And this is where we come across a group that you may have heard of before, known as the Mujahideen. And they're a collective group. So it's not a cohesive group of people.
No.
The Mujahideen. It's just kind of the name given to these guerrilla warfare groups. They were Shia Muslims, there were Maoists. In the groups.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different groups within the Mujahideen. And they begin an insurgency.
Another thing that we need to sort of point out is, you know, communism also is like secular. They don't like religion.
Yes,
they see that religion divides the people. So
yeah, a lot of the groups are religious.
As deeply religious as Afghanistan is, a lot of it came from these Muslim leaders.
Yeah, so a lot of the groups that get involved with the Mujahideen are extremely religious. So most notably, obviously, the Islamic groups. They essentially start a guerrilla war against the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan.
And they are supported by none other than.
Yeah, so the government in Afghanistan are like, we need help. Who's communist? Well, the Soviets are communist and they're close by. Soviets do come in and support the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan through weapons, but also soldiers.
Yes.
So there's a lot of Soviet forces do come with that support and do try and fight this guerrilla war. As far as guerrilla wars go, as a history teacher, when you see guerrilla war, you kind of know who's going to win that, I feel.
For sure, yeah. And I find it really interesting that, like, it's called the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but they were there to, like, it's kind of misleading. They were there to help the government. You know,
well, I feel like this is so. The Soviet Afghan War, I feel, is the Soviet Union's Vietnam, right?
Yes,
because you know,
actually, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, so
which
like,
is smart.
Yeah, well, thank you. because obviously, like, you know, the Americans supported the South Vietnamese government in the same way, and you know, it's called by the Vietnamese as the American invasion of Vietnam.
American invasion.
It's a similar thing, I think, in that the Soviets are kind of propping up a regime that is like their own. In a country that's not theirs. So And
as a result of this ideological conflict.
Yeah, and I think so. You know, all the like, so the Mujahideen are fighting for, you know, what they perceive as their country and their freedom from a government that they see as coming from somewhere else, I guess.
Yeah.
And in that way, I also feel like, you know, that like that's those are the types of wars that the invading armies are never going to win. Because they're not defending anything good necessarily. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Or at least they're not going to have the passion to defend it as much as somewhere else. The political will to keep going.
And they're not fighting a clear, united, you know, enemy in like a uniform. You know,
it's not like you're punching Nazis or anything, is it?
It's tactically difficult to, you don't know who the enemy are.
Yes.
Anyone.
Yeah. And so this also becomes another cold war, proxy war, because the United States see it as a place to really crush the already crumbling Soviet Union, right? So the Soviets, we're at a point now sort of getting into the 80s where the Soviet Union is not doing well.
And we'll just stop.
Yep.
James is getting antsy, I can tell.
Yeah, go, James, go. I'm not looking at your camera, James. Go. Well, what have you got for us?
He's screen sharing and he was like moving it. I'm like,
I wasn't looking at the Zoom.
Khan and most of his family were assassinated on the 28th of April, 78. And so their bodies actually weren't discovered until 2008.
Wow, okay.
In two separate graves outside the walls of a prison in Kabul. So 16 corpses in one grave and 12 in a second.
Still doesn't tell us how he died, though.
No. Well,
that's unfortunate.
I guess by that, it's difficult to tell by that point, I guess.
Mass graves kind of tell me he was shot.
Thanks, James. We know what assassination means. He's hovering over assassination there.
He was killed.
Yeah, he was killed. Okay. Thank you, James. Thank you.
We just have a morbid curiosity.
So back to the Soviets. It becomes
a crumbling.
And it becomes a proxy war. The United States see it as a way to fight the Cold War without fighting a war. You know, like so many other things that happen during that time period. And so this is where the much kind of advertised or reported on support from US, the CIA and the providing of weapons to the Mujahideen to fight their civil war, or what they saw as a civil war. We could have done a whole episode on this, I think, but the idea here is that the Soviets are fighting a war that they're probably not going to win, and the United States see it as an opportunity to keep them undermine occupied them. And also, I guess cripple their resources in a war that is not winnable.
And they know exactly what that feels like because
they've just come out of one. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
They're like, this really sucked for us.
Let's, yeah. So
let's
here you
do
go.
It to them.
The Mujahideen pretty successful at crippling the Soviet army. There's a lot
and
of stuff you could talk about.
See,
but, yeah, go for it.
Like, because we're heading towards September 11 and the American invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. All of which is kind of orchestrated by Osama bin Laden, and so it's in this conflict that we sort of first get to see Osama bin Laden. So he is not an Afghan, he's Saudi.
Yes.
But he is an Islamic extremist, and he makes his first trip to Afghanistan, first documented trip. He reckons he went immediately after the Soviet invasion, but the first documented trip is in 1984,
right,
to fight with the Mujahideen.
Yeah, and
so
this
all
is
those stories about, like, you know, the Americans trained Osama bin Laden and all of that, like, you know, he fought with the Mujahideen and the Mujahideen were supported by yes. America.
And so, that's also, so one of the things about the Mujahideen, like we talked about, was that they were just a conglomeration of all sorts of different factions. Just
everyone who hated the Soviets.
And one of the things that, happens kind of a lot in the decades post this is that, you know, when there is an Islamic cause to fight for, there's a lot of kind of radical Muslims who will come and fight for you. And so that is one of the things that happens. They get a lot of guys from Saudi Arabia who are kind of recruited by Osama bin Laden, come with him to fight for the Mujahideen. And kind of the goal, according to, I read this. So Osama bin Laden, stated that the goal for them in what they were trying to do was to reclaim what always was an Islamic state in their mind. You know, get rid of the oppressors, and reinstate the Islamic rule of a country that they always saw as Islamic.
And at this stage, the oppressors are the Soviets.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's later that, you know, he then turns to the Americans.
Well, yeah, I mean, he turns on the American, I mean, I'm not sure we'll get into this next week too, but
we will. Yeah.
He turns on the Americans.
We're getting into dangerous territory.
but he turns on the Americans essentially because of the balance of power that shifts in the world, I would say.
Yeah.
It's a fight of convenience. Like the Soviets are defeated. Well, who's the next biggest target? And so that kind
and
of
becomes
a thing.
And they both are sort of seen as, I don't know, like these superpowers that have lost or don't have any sort of religious respect is the wrong word. I don't know. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's wanting to reclaim the world for Islam.
Sure.
And both the Soviet Union and the Americans are seen as sort of like godless.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's where like the ideology comes into it, I guess.
So the end of this conflict between the Soviets and the Afghans ends with the Soviet withdrawal of Afghanistan.
10 years of, you know, civil war and Soviet occupation.
Yeah, and so the Soviets withdraw their forces, but then it leads kind of straight into a proper civil war. So I guess, you know, they might have seen themselves as not fighting a civil war at first, or fighting to get rid of the Soviet, you know, oppressors and kind of overthrow the government. But eventually, it does become what would be a civil war. And the civil war itself, like technically, a lot of people say has never finished. A lot of sources that I saw say that the Afghanistan civil war started in 1978 and is ongoing.
Yeah. I kind of agree with that because, you know, we've got the peace treaties are signed in Geneva in 1989, is it? So that's when the Soviet Union withdraw. They've still got the Soviet-backed president in place at that time. And then so from 1989 onwards, the Mujahideen are just fighting him.
Yes, and he, and then, Amin, so that's Amin? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
Check the name.
I'm pretty sure. So he and they hang around until 1992, which is the fall of Kabul, and kind of the end of the Republic of Afghanistan, as it is. So they fight on for a good while. But I suppose maybe the reason why they say that this is ongoing is that, you know, people take control of Kabul, and they have control of some of the cities. But then who really has control of Afghanistan? I feel like after this point in time, and even before this, like a lot of the other governments, did they, and it's like you said before, did they ever really have control of the entirety of the country? And it's
well, yeah, and that's like there's effectively no government, really.
So what happens post 1992 is the Islamic state of Afghanistan, and this is so the Mujahideen kind of they overthrow Kabul, and then they kind of get together and go, well, who's gonna do what, you know, because they were factions and quite factional within the group. So who's gonna control the actual country itself, and the Taliban being the largest group within the Mujahideen itself kind of just take de facto power de facto control of the government at the time, is what I read.
So, yeah. So this is probably where it comes, like, gets confusing, and we maybe need to break it down. So you've got the Mujahideen, you've got the Taliban, and you've got Al Qaeda. Like, what are the similarities? What are the differences?
Like,
you reckon?
Okay, so I think so. Like I said, when we tried to dissect what the Mujahideen were before, the Mujahideen is just like a title for the group of people who were fighting the Soviets / the Republic. So that's kind of just, you know, it's like a team name, I guess.
It's the phrase for everybody, yeah.
Yeah. But then within the Mujahideen, you get the rise of the Taliban.
And they're your Islamic extremists.
They're the Islamic extremists, right? So they're they were from what I like, it was hard to kind of get it all together, because a lot of things that I read say that the Taliban don't really start until 1994, although like a lot of the core members of the Taliban were fighting in the Mujahideen as
before. Yeah,
like,
yeah, I think it's hard because there's like no clear date, so like things sort of starting, but they're growing in power. So like, from what I could understand, I got the same sort of date around like 1994, 1995 is like where the Taliban is, starting to exercise more and more power. And they are based in Kandahar, the second largest city in Afghanistan. And it sort of started as a bunch of young men, like students.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, like idealized, and they've trained in seminaries. And I listened to Dan Snow's podcast on this.
He
had a Pakistani journalist on, and his name is Rashid Khan, and he spent a lot of time with the Taliban. And he said like the Taliban made the Mujahideen look like, you know, fun-loving westernized sort of guys, because they were so extreme in their rejection of anything Western, which kind of includes technology,
right,
like, and music, cult, like anything like that, not interested. They follow a very, very strict and conservative interpretation of Islam, which is like, you know, the Sharia law type stuff.
Sure. Yep. Yep.
You know,
which interestingly,
and then from there you've got Al Qaeda.
Yeah. So okay. Like, just quickly, can I just one of the things on the Taliban that I find fascinating, especially because you just brought up the religious views of the Taliban and how conservative they are. They're mostly funded by their sale of heroin.
We don't believe in it, but if we can make money off it.
Yeah, so like one of the reasons why Afghanistan is so well known for the growth of poppies is it comes from the Taliban control, in which they were mostly funded by the sale of illegal drugs, essentially.
Is that where the British got all their poppies from back in the 19th century?
The British, a lot of poppies were grown in northern India, which I guess technically could be Afghanistan, depending on the time period we're talking about. So I'm not entirely certain, but I know that's where they got, like, so they, when you're looking at the opium wars, the opium that was coming into China was being brought from India, is what most of the sources talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So,
which at the time would have had a direct border with Afghanistan.
Yeah. Or possibly even would have been Afghanistan, depending on, you know, who was.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Hopefully the listeners know what I mean. So Al Qaeda is a group. This is confusing too. Because
I guess like the biggest distinction is like they're terrorists.
They're terrorist cells, right? So they're not necessarily one cohesive group again, right? Which I feel like possibly is something that maybe Osama bin Laden learned from his time in the Mujahideen. That, you know, you can effectively work as separate entities that all kind of strive for the same goal, but we might talk about that a bit more next week as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, Osama bin Laden founds it in 1988. And there's quite a few people who were fighting with him in the Mujahideen, but they're not necessarily, I don't think any of them, any of the foundation members were actually from Afghanistan.
Yeah, I didn't look into that. I knew there were about 15 others.
I think
15 other Islamists is all I sort of wrote down.
And the distinction that I found too was that so a lot of the Mujahideen, the largest group of Muslims in the Mujahideen were Shia Muslims.
Yeah.
But significantly, the Al Qaeda formation is a militant Sunni. Organization. So they're on the other side of the
Muslim
coin. Which
we're not going to get into because we will say something wrong. We'll stuff it up. I'm not going to get into it. If you don't know the difference, Google it.
It's
complicated.
It is extremely complicated. I really enjoy doing it if you do it in studies of religion, as a topic to teach, because it's really fascinating the way that all worked out. So if you do want to look at that, I do recommend having a Google of that. There's a bunch of groups working in Afghanistan now. So the Taliban, who are mostly Afghans and who are extremist Muslims.
Yeah.
Are they Shia? I can't remember.
Taliban? I think they're Sunni.
And they're Sunni as well?
Yeah, I think so.
Which is interesting because the
fact check, James.
Majority of the Mujahideen were Shia, which is interesting. I don't know. Anyway, so the Taliban who have kind of taken over regionally in Afghanistan at this time, and they're essentially... They're kind of warlordy, I guess, is what I want to say.
This is an interesting quote that I found that I think sort of sums up how the Taliban came to be powerful as they were. So they were mostly exiles during the conflict with the Soviet Union, and then they started to come back in the early 90s, and they were grew in popularity on the premise of peace. And if you think about it at this stage, the Afghans have been sort of experiencing instability for a really, really long time. So they were promising peace. They didn't want power for themselves initially. They were trying to rid Afghanistan of instability, violence, and the impunity of the warlords, which was, that sounded good to the people.
Because what kind of happens that, so like, this whole time period here is really murky, right? Because once the Soviets leave and the Taliban take Kabul, and then they're ruling out of Kandahar, but then there's also a bunch of Mujahideen warlords in other cities around Afghanistan. So
they've been fighting together, but as soon as the Soviets leave, they kind of turn on each other.
They turn on each other and they rule their own little kingdoms in Afghanistan. And so because the Taliban were the biggest organization within that group at the time and the most powerful at that point, they do start to try and get rid of the Mujahideen warlords and try and take power away from them. And the people, like you said, the people do like that idea. And as eventually they get to the point where they can declare the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is established in 1996. And they moved the capital to Kandahar after that time. But of course, so Al Qaeda is working in the background now in Afghanistan and other places around the world too. They don't just stay in Afghanistan. They go back to Saudi Arabia, a lot of them, and they move around the place. But what Taliban rule in Afghanistan does is it allows for a lot of these people to just stay and hide out when they want to.
Yeah. So there were a couple of instances, especially in 1998, Al Qaeda orchestrated bombings of US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. And the US, he was in Afghanistan, the US demanded that he be extradited to like face charges of terrorism.
Yep.
And the Taliban said no.
Yeah.
So like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda don't necessarily like see eye to eye on everything, but what's happening is the Taliban is protecting these terrorists and not negotiating with other countries to, you know, hand them over when they ask. And that's when the American eye sort of turns to Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I also found it really interesting that in the sort of early 90s, this is a quote from like a US press conference. They found nothing objectionable about the Taliban's application of Islamic law.
Okay.
In the first half of the 90s.
Okay? Right, right.
And can you think why they would find nothing objectionable about the application of Islamic law in Afghanistan? it comes down to like economic stuff, right? Like,
okay.
There's a company called Unocal that's trying to build a trans-Afghan oil pipeline.
Of course.
And so they need to negotiate with the Taliban to be able to do that. And then once it becomes like a situation where people don't want to invest in it anymore, it's seen as kind of a not as a lucrative idea that it was thought to be before. And that's when American rhetoric sort of changes politically.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's hard not to be cynical about it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Taliban and the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan—they're our government that ends this time period all the way up to 2001, and it's messy.
Sure is.
Oh, James has found for me
Taliban ideology.
Yeah, it's an Islamic revivalist movement within the Sunni. Is it a sect?
I think it's a sect.
Sect. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Sect. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
I guess like towards the late 90s, we're just seeing an increasing conflict between, a rise in terrorist activity.
Yep.
Being protected by the Taliban in Afghanistan.
That's right.
Which is going to take us up to. So I think next week we'll start with sort of a bit of background on September 11
and we'll go from there. Yeah. So
sounds good.
Whew.
All right. I hope we haven't confused you guys.
If not, you can send an email to Siobhan.Doherty.
Don't give me. There aren't many other Siobhan Doherty's out there. I'm the only one.
All right. Well.
All right. Cool.
And that's how it came to this. As always, you can catch us by email, howdiditcometothispodcast@gmail.com. We're also available on Twitter and Facebook at HDICTT Podcast. If you like the show, could you please go and review us if you can on iTunes? It really helps us out. How Did It Come to This is written by Daniel Matters and Siobhan Doherty. Our producer is James Tuckwell, edited by Daniel Matters, original music by Lachlan McWhirter.
Don't laugh at me, James.
I think that was good.
Yeah, except I forgot that's how it came to this bit.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Oh, yeah, that's what we do.
All good.
Rusty.
That's all right.
Yeah, I think that's...
It's hard not seeing you guys, and reacting to you.
Yeah. So we're dealing with, technology, and I think we took a very complicated thing and simplified it.
I hope so.
Do you feel like you know stuff, James, that you didn't know before? I can't hear you. Are you muted?
There we go.
Ah, hi.
There we go.
Yeah, I wasn't listening.
You weren't listening.